Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Graham, Edelman's Global President of Practices and Sectors and Global Health Chair. Thank you for joining Trustmakers. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. Our guest today is Sally Sussman. She's Pfizer's Chief Corporate Affairs Officer and the Vice Chair of the Pfizer Foundation. Sally was named one of Forbes' most influential CMOs in the world last year and is now just weeks away from releasing her first book, Breaking Through, Communicating to Open Minds, Move Hearts, and Change the World. Sally, I'm thrilled to talk to you today. I had the privilege of being part of your team at Pfizer for 10 years, and I have profound respect for your skills and feel lucky to call you a friend and a mentor. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Kirsty. It is always a pleasure for me to talk to you, and delighted to be here on International Women's Day since you are one of the women I truly, truly admire.
Thank you, Sally. I would say congratulations on the book. I have read it. I think it's an amazing read. And I say that because I think it's that rare combination of being deeply personal and yet really, really practical and full of a lot of specifics that I think anybody in either a leadership position or in the communications, corporate affairs, any of those roles, I think people will take an enormous amount from this book, from the very practical suggestions that you give over your career. So can I start by saying, you know, there's a lot in the book around what you learned in the intensity of what Pfizer was going through during the pandemic. But you also reflect on, you know, your whole career in corporate affairs and comms. And it made me wonder if you think the business of communications changed at all in the pandemic, you know, what we've come through in the last 3 years, has that changed the course of communications?
It's a great question. And it's a good time, Kirsty, to ask the question because we're really on the 3-year anniversary of the pandemic. And thanks to some excellent polling data that you conducted for us, we know that most of the world is really wanting to move on from COVID and not think about it. I feel it's really important that we reflect on the COVID experience, you know, what we learned, what went well, some of the pain and anguish that remained, some of the very difficult and sad things that happened cannot be brushed over. As it relates to my book, and thank you for your kind words about the book, it means a lot to me. I wrote it for people like us, you know, people in our profession and leaders generally, who just want to connect and know the importance of that line that runs tightly between great leaders and great communicators. So that's who the book is for. And just a word of background to say that I always have thought of myself as a writer, and I always wanted to write a book, and I have kept notes and I've published smaller pieces. But it really wasn't until I was working at Pfizer, you know, on the front lines of rolling out a new vaccine using technology that had never been tested before, that all of my thoughts crystallized. I also had the clarity, thanks to the pandemic, to write the book at the same time. So it's not a book about the pandemic. It opens and closes with two stories from my experiences in the pandemic. And then, as you say, it carries through my life in other companies, in government. It was funny, one person who also read a pre-publication copy said, this is a memoir hiding in a business book. And I think, you know, we only have our stories, and I'm grateful for the chance to tell them. Now to quickly answer your question, how communications changed during the pandemic, it just insisted on more transparency in every way. Things that pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer used to keep private, like our clinical trial protocols, we published on our website. The availability of our CEO, Albert Bourla, and our scientists was virtually 24/7. There were so many important takeaways, and I think reflecting on them with you and other leaders at Edelman is something really important to do.
And maybe a follow-up to that, Sally, you know, when I think about what it was like when we were all moving remote in most cases, you know, the lines between the personal and the professional. We all saw each other's families. We saw where we were living. You know, there was a lot more vulnerability. There was a level of informality. It really changed in a way what leadership and what showing up looked like. Do you think those changes were positive, and do you think they're permanent?
I do think they were positive. I always kept a rigid line between who I was at work and who I was at home. And I wasn't a big fan of, you know, casual dress or work from home Friday. And I was proven wrong on so many things. I mean, the world was incredibly productive working remotely, and there was a lot to be gained from it. And I feel like, as you're describing on the video calls and stuff, I got to see people's kids, their dogs and cats, the art they have on their wall at home. And I found it very humanizing and helped to make more three-dimensional. You know, that being said, I still think it's tremendously important that we come together in the workspace as teams. And here at Pfizer now, I'm spending 3 days a week in the office, and I'm really liking it. I'm liking being back together with people, teaching, apprenticeship, problem solving together. These are things that are really important to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about what has happened to the communications of science as well. Part of a discussion in Davos where a participant said, you know, what has happened is that we have to be able to connect science in a way that's much more personal, that is much more emotional. If you think about that, we had a pandemic and also an infodemic. We're living in really polarized times. You know, you make a lot of really great examples in the book about how you change the approach of comms in the pandemic and given what Pfizer was going through. Can you say a little bit about how you did make those connections more immediate and more emotional to people as you explained the science?
So science, which used to be sort of a remote, esoteric discussion, during the pandemic became everybody's dinner conversation. Did you test today? Is so-and-so positive? What do you think about wearing a mask? And I think that's a change that is actually for the good. It had a lot of positive outcomes. For example, we were able to field our clinical trial for our COVID vaccines so quickly because everybody was engaged in it. It wasn't, you know, like a rare disease that affects only a few people. So the fact that there was democracy to the pandemic in that it didn't know boundaries, it didn't know class differentiation, it didn't know gender. It was just this virus impacting everyone, meant that people, families, children, grandma, grandpa, were all talking about science. And I'm very proud of the Science Will Win campaign that we did. It wasn't Pfizer Will Win. It was Science Will Win, because science was the hero of the pandemic. And I think that brought a humanizing relevancy to science that hadn't maybe existed before.
I love that description in the book when you talk about the Science Will Win campaign and just how you had a much broader sense of stakeholders and knowing the immediacy to get to them. As we think about, you know, what technology is doing to the way we operate, I was so struck in the book by the really important practices of civility, of good manners, of the importance of personal relationships, of thank you notes. You know, those were incredibly compelling stories. And when I think about how we've become so data-driven, when we see where technology is going, will those, let's call them practices, will they continue? How do we make sure that though the personal, the art of the personal and civility stays in our communications landscape?
It's very personal to me. And Kirstie, I know it is to you as well, because we've shared stories about our parents and our upbringing. I believe that thanking people, looking people in the eye, handshakes, these kind of old-fashioned customs are very, very important. And I've just moved into a new office here in Hudson Yards, where it's very high-tech, very modern, very cool. But still, by my computer, I have a box. And in that box, I keep funny cards and stationery and all kinds of writing specialty papers, so that I try almost on a daily basis to write a thank you note to someone who had me to their home, someone who did a thankless task. And I write in the book some suggestions about how to be an effective and expressing gratitude. And it's never too late to do it. It's important to be specific. What am I thanking you for? How did it make me feel? What does it leave me in a different place than when you found me? And I have found that thread through many of the CEOs and political leaders that I've worked for. Some of the ones that are best are known for this, like Leonard Lauder, who's the chairman of the Estee Lauder companies. He and his mom wrote personal thank you notes to all the people who were their customers. George Bush, the president, was famous for his thank you notes. Mm. Anybody can write a thank you note. It's an easy thing to do, but it is a profound expression of gratitude. And it's distinguishing, not just a text or an email, but an actual letter put through the post.
I think that's very compelling. And I also love that tenet that you have throughout the book of, you know, communications is a really important part of leadership. And so when you talked about the CEOs you've worked for, I was fascinated. You know, you've worked for 9 CEOs, been a direct report for 6. Did they all view the comms or the corporate affairs function in the same way? How did you convince them of the value of the function?
No, they didn't all think about it the same way. And I like to joke that the really smart ones very much valued it. But at some level, they all valued it. Some knew how to use the functionality and the expertise more easily than others. The man I work for now, Albert Bourla, is an extraordinary partner to my department and deeply involved in all of the things that we do. I do think as time has progressed, it's become more and more relevant to leaders. I'm often invited to speak to business schools. There is a sense now that the work that we do in communications and public affairs is as essential to the success of a business leader as accounting, finance, you know, marketing, manufacturing. And the really smartest and best chief executives and aspiring leaders across the board, they know that and they want it. And it's a great thing, you know, there's the old argument that was always made, oh, we have to get a seat at the table. My feeling is we've got a seat and it's a hot seat. And you better be ready to be around the board table and have a good answer to the questions and be really engaged. Don't take that seat for granted.
I think many who read this book and who know how you operate, Sally, will be grateful for how you have taken the corporate affairs function, you know, as a really significant part of the C-suite. And that made me also think about the construct. You know, I spend a lot of time advising various companies on the, in many cases, it's more the comms function. But I know in your organization, you're the head of corporate affairs. And in that, you have comms, you have policy, you have public affairs, sustainability or CSR, as well as investor relations. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution and what are the benefits of that model?
Absolutely. And I am a huge cheerleader for our industry. I think those of us who work in this space are lucky. The hardest question I ever get is, can you tell me what an average day is like in your role? I've never had an average day in my role. Every day is different. And I do believe that when all these functions are united, that it works better, that it's more aligned, that it's simplified, that it's clear, that it's more powerful. But I didn't have that from the beginning. So when I first came to Pfizer 15 years ago, I was in charge of comms. And I wanted more. I had done more in other companies. But my boss at the time said to me, this is a big place. Biopharmaceuticals is a complicated industry. Do this, do it well, and the rest will come. And it was the Pfizer Foundation that came next. And then it was U.S. government relations, ultimately global government relations, and so on, with the latest addition being investor relations about a year and a half ago. And that was a big lesson for me, Kirsty, to really learn to walk before you run. I can be impatient. I know lots of other people can be impatient. And you're not doing yourselves any favor if you get too far ahead of yourself. And it's important to be successful at what you're doing and to feel in command of what you're doing. And so if that portfolio comes together over time, that's a good thing.
In the book, you have there's some wonderfully funny moments as well. And you have this great description of a trip to China early on in your career. And, you know, And I think we've all been there when you have this desire to, you've jet lagged, you want to stay, you know, maybe I should just have room service, go to bed. But no, you were taken out to see local things, to go and engage. I'm curious when I think about, you know, how often you talk about the classroom of daily life and how important some of the things you learned from your parents. You know, you and I have talked about the experiences we had of the value of travel and what that has meant. But it made me also wonder what traits you look for when you're hiring for people into your department, for comms, for policy, for public affairs. What are you looking for?
The story that you mentioned, though, I just have to take a moment to say that I was fortunate enough when I was new in my role at the Estee Lauder companies to travel with the then vice chairman, Jeanette Sarkeesian Wagner, who is a woman that ultimately became my mentor over time. And yes, we were in China. I was dying for room service and a soak in the tub. And she says, we're going out. And we went out and we met her friend. And I learned a lot about his life and his business and saw this local, local dining experience in Beijing. And she said to me, dear, jet lag is boring. And that whenever you go anywhere, you need to get out and see something very real. So that has been a rule of mine and something I've done with my team. And sometimes I think people think it's kooky that I'm dragging them around on hikes or to presidential libraries and things like that. But it speaks to being curious. In my book, I have 10 principles. So it's fairly simple, but I think they're powerful. And one of them is the importance of remaining curious, to be a question asker, to seek out new horizons, to challenge oneself, to do things that are hard to do. So I'm a big proponent of curiosity, and I certainly look for that in people I hire. Be warned, I really like to hire people from agencies. I think agency experience is a great experience. A lot of times, you know, we have the pleasure and the great joy of working with firms like Edelman and others, where I meet a lot of really talented people. And I like hiring people that I have some experience of. Hiring is kind of like dating and marriage. You know, it's nice to get to know someone before you sign on the dotted line to marry them. And I feel that way about hiring people. You don't want to just take this big leap of faith, but really have an opportunity to get to know people by working together.
You know, and at the end of the book, you also reflect on the importance of harmony. It struck me when I was thinking about the findings in our trust barometer and how incredibly polarized the world is globally at the moment. You know, there's some shocking statistic in our last report about how people feel if they disagree with someone, are they willing to help them? That's 30%. Are they willing to live near them? 20%. These numbers are surprising and worrying. Sally, another thing that you, the point that you make in the book around this perception that good communications are soft skills being wrong and that actually it's a rock hard competency. I think everybody in our industry will jump for joy and be very grateful that you have made that link. How do you think this is playing out in the company landscape? People tend to think that empathy is something that this function does as opposed to the whole company. Where do you think that positioning now sits?
Great questions, Kirsty, as always. I think we make great progress on the rock hard competency question. You know, I'm a cheerleader for this industry and I'm going to continue to beat that drum, but I believe we've made great, great progress. The old question, do we have a seat at the table, doesn't even feel relevant anymore because we've got a seat that's the hot seat and people have to be prepared and ready to be about around the boardroom table, in front of a CEO, in front of a client. You know, I believe we've made great progress on this and that it is an accepted competency for any leader right alongside finance, manufacturing, any key competency. In terms of empathy, empathy is not the province of the communications team. It is another essential element of leadership. I believe it's incredibly important for firms and companies to have values, not politics, but values. And at Pfizer, we have four: courage, excellence, equity, and joy. And there's a lot of empathy in all of that, and a lot of heart a lot of daring, a lot of, you know, willingness to be compassionate, to be spirited. And I believe that is what culture is about. And that's why it's important that we build cultures, that we work together, and that we create environment that people really want to come and work in. I know you care a lot about that too.
And I think that crystallization down to four values, I know Joy, you talk about that in the book and how important that was to have and your role in that. I thought it's a very special part of, I think, what is in the culture that you have built around this. Today is International Women's Day, and you have this another really interesting piece in the book when you talk about the need to debunk the negativity of ambition and what you think ambition represents. What advice do you give to women? Because I think it's an area where women often feel that things are tricky or that their behaviors are misinterpreted. How do you think about ambition, and particularly for women?
I was actually thinking about it just today because Arianna Huffington has a wonderful blog newsletter called Thrive. And she sent a question out to all of her followers where she asked about who was the woman that inspired you. And she said, you know, it could be a teacher, it could be a boss, it could be your mom, or it could be anybody. And I really stopped and thought about how much I value learning from female peers and colleagues. I'm very fortunate to sit on an executive committee with four women, and they are each strong, and I learn a lot from them. In particular, today, I was admiring Angela Wong, who is, you know, Pfizer's chief commercial officer, and a very strong, compassionate woman who likes to work hard and is joyful in the way she does it. And I'm really been thinking a lot for women about ideas of peer mentoring. And you and I peer mentor each other quite a bit. In fact, you called me for advice last week and I called you for advice yesterday.
So, that's true.
I think that a real avenue of opportunity for women in business is to truly help each other and to find people at your own level with whom you can share ideas, share vulnerabilities, help one another, let that ambition flow and support it.
A final question then. When you think about the intensity of what you've lived the last few years, and you know those chapters in the book are very moving because, and you quote Billie Jean King, you know, that the pressure is privilege, that it comes to those who earn it. And I was thinking, you were in an unbelievably pressured environment. What have you learned about society, about your company, about Pfizer, and about yourself in these last intense few years?
Thank you, Kirsty. Those are very kind comments. And I do believe what Billie Jean says is true. Pressure is a privilege. During some of the most difficult days during the pandemic and Pfizer's race to get a vaccine, a dear friend called me who had worked to help rebuild New York City after 9/11. And he said to me, "Sally, the only thing harder than being at the heart of a crisis is being on the sidelines of a crisis." So I feel enormously fortunate to have been in the crucible of the pandemic. And to answer your question, three things changed profoundly. The first one was the science. When we found out in, I think it was November 8th, that our vaccine was 95%+ effective, our chief scientist said, "This is the greatest medical advance in a century." Mm-hmm. I mean, mRNA is going to be a part of a wave of a whole new scientific renaissance that's going to be amazing. The second thing is it changed Pfizer. Pfizer was a company like a lot of biopharmaceutical companies that struggled with reputation issues, that found ourselves down at the bottom of the charts next to tobacco or oil and gas. And this was painful for us. And for most of my 15 years, I had worked to try to fix that without a lot of success. Fortune magazine named Pfizer one of the top 10 most admired companies 2 years in a row. Mm. So the science was transformed. Pfizer's reputation was transformed from a laggard to a leading brand. And we as individuals were transformed. Albert, my boss, likes to say, people don't know what they're capable of. And it's true. You really don't know what you're capable of until it all comes bearing down on you and you find strength and you find clarity. Amazing teamwork with my colleagues here at Pfizer. The clarity to be able to launch this vaccine. and write this book happened during this busiest time. It seems an odd thing to say, but in many ways, I'm so grateful for the things I learned in the pandemic.
Sally, I think that is the perfect way to end this session. And I want to thank you for this wonderfully rich conversation we've had. You've been a trailblazer for women, for comms professionals, and for business leaders at the highest level. So thank you very much for sharing your time and your insights today. For those of you who are looking for a copy of Breaking Through, it's going to be released on March 28th, and the link to purchase the book is in this episode's show notes. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.